For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
For Mildred Hofle, who gave me books when I needed them most. And for Lily and Charlie, my little beams of light. You know the story of John Wayne Gacy. You've seen the pictures of the smiling clown standing proudly outside the suburban home. You've heard of the young men and boys buried in the dark crawl space below Gacy's ranch house. Maybe you've watched the news footage of the investigators bringing them out from the house in white body bags and loading them into a coroner's van, the flash of camera lights illuminating it all for the eyes of America. But you don't know the story of these boys. You might think you know. You might have heard of them called dismissed as runaways or hustlers, but you don't know their names. You don't know their families, where they come from, how they live their lives in short bursts of light and love. Welcome, friends. My name is Patricia, or most people call me Patches, and I'm the owner and host of the Morbidly Curious Book Club, a nonfiction-only book club diving into the darker macabre parts of your library. And today we are discussing yet another morbid topic that some people completely opted out of reading. Our November book was Boys Enter the House, The Victims of John Wayne Gacy and the Lives They Left Behind by David Nelson, and I'm thrilled to chat with him today about this profound true crime book. As investigators brought out the bagged remains of several dozen young men from a small Chicago ranch home and paraded them in front of a crowd of TV reporters and spectators, attention quickly turned to the owner of the house. John Gacy was an upstanding citizen, active in local politics and charities, famous for his themed parties and appearances as Pogo the Clown. But in the winter of 1978-79, he became known as one of many so-called sex murderers, who had begun gaining notoriety in the random brutality of the 1970s. As public interest grew rapidly, victims became footnotes and statistics, lives lost not just to violence, but to history. Through the testimony of siblings, parents, friends, lovers, and other witnesses close to the case, Boys Enter the House retraces the footsteps of these victims as they make their way to the doorstep of the Gacy House itself. So David Nelson is a Chicago-based author whose fiction has been published in the Rappahannock Review, the Tishman Review, and another Chicago magazine. His work has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize and received honorable mentions from Glimmer Train. His coverage of ongoing war crime trials and the DNA identification process for victims of the Balkans conflicts was published by the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, IWPR. He is a graduate of Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. Again, I'm very excited to chat with him today. I hope you guys enjoyed the episode, and be sure to stay to the end to hear about the current podcast-exclusive giveaway going on. So let's start all the way at the beginning and talk about you as a journalist and your writing journey. Tell us how you got into journalism, why you got into journalism, what got you into writing. Let's just start at the very beginning. The genesis of the Nelson writing experience.
Well, I've definitely been writing like almost all my life. But after college, there's that like dip in your life where you're like, well, what the hell do I do now? Also, can I swear on this? Is that all right?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay.
Let it rip.
So I didn't know what to do with myself after college, but I knew I wanted to do something with writing. But it didn't make sense to that I was going to make a living off writing fiction or anything like that. So
sure.
The next most reasonable thing was journalism. And I knew my brother was at Northwestern at the time. So I knew it was a really good school, and I just decided that I was going to make the leap to go to Northwestern School of Journalism, and I got in very quickly. It was kind of like the tail end of like application season. It was like, I think it was like in May or June that I applied, and I got in like within a month because they needed to like start making decisions, and all of a sudden I was like, okay, I guess I'm moving to Chicago. Which was kind of always a goal. I think when you live in the Midwest, Chicago is kind of like, I'm going to Hollywood kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just kind of a natural progression for me, and my brother was here too. So I, you know, kind of had someone else here as a kind of a safety net. But so that's how I got here and then got into journalism.
I love that. Yeah, I've only been to the airport in Chicago, but I've always wanted to go explore. Yeah, it was a layover. I was there for 40 minutes, so I guess, to be honest, I haven't been to Chicago. But
oh, no, you saw everything. That's all you need. That's all you need.
I saw the artwork. I saw everything. Yeah, mm-hmm. The airport's beautiful.
Yeah.
So what steered you to true crime? Where did that sprout out from?
I was always into true crime. Growing up, I was always gravitating to the worst news stories that were on the news at the time. I probably shouldn't have been watching the news and like absorbing that as a kid. I mean, I guess they turned out all right, but I remember seeing the Menendez brothers on television. I remember seeing OJ on television, JonBenet Ramsey. Like, this was the 90s. Mm-hmm. And like, so those crimes have like a, I hate to say it like this, but like a place in my heart. Oh, it's such a weird way, but it just like, those are like kind of part of growing up for me, is those were in the background playing. And oh, I hate the way I phrase that though.
No, it's true. I completely resonate with that because mm-hmm. it's, you're watching a very traumatic thing that's very new to you.
Yeah.
So of course it's going to have like a place of memory.
Yeah.
Embedded in you.
Exactly. No, yeah. And I was always kind of scared as a kid too. Like, just like, I assumed that like whoever killed JonBenet was going to like come in and kill me. Like, I had had those kind of weird, like, nightmares sort of. Mm-hmm. And then when the internet came along, there was I think it was like courttv.com or something, or crimelibrary.com. And I would sit there after school with the, like, you know, the dial up internet, reading about these horrific crimes and then scaring myself again. And I do remember reading about the John Wayne Gacy case. So I still had like a foundation of knowledge before I like started kind of seriously researching it. And it just kind of, I carried that with me like all through all stages of my life. And I still absorb true crime, you know, just as much as everybody else does right now, kind of.
It's huge now. Yeah. It's everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's everywhere. And I don't have like a singular moment myself in my childhood, because of course when people are like, oh, you host this book club, what got you into all this, I'm like, I don't know, it's always been something that's fascinated me, you know. It's like it's like watching a train wreck, of course people are gonna, you know,
I know, yeah,
people might turn their heads, you know, it's just one of those things. So but there's not a singular moment where I'm in my history where I'm like, that was the moment that I was into. But I do feel mm-hmm. like Gacy was definitely part of that for me. I remember mm-hmm. discovering him and like Dahmer in like high school or whatever, yeah. and like falling down this rabbit hole of like, how can somebody do this yeah. type of thing? And, mm-hmm. and you do, like, when you are a kid and you're seeing, or even a teenager and you're seeing all these horrible things happen, or even now, like, just horrible things happen to kids or women, and you're just like, I mean, yeah. how do I prevent this from happening to me type mm-hmm. of thing? It's almost mm-hmm. like it's almost like you're trying to protect yourself.
Absolutely.
I resonate with that so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Menendez might get out. I don't know if you've been keeping up with that. Isn't that crazy?
You know, I just was talking about that with someone the other day, too, and I'm like, I watched the show, too, which was okay, but yeah. not to go off on another case, but yeah, I'm curious about how that one's going to turn out, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge supporter of their freedom, so I'm hoping that it works out, but we'll see.
It's a horrible thing that they did, but what is worse is kind of I don't know how to balance that, but even the prosecutor for that case said the world is better off with Jose Menendez in it. And I'm like, that is so telling. They couldn't find a character witness to say he was a nice guy. And I'm like, how must he have been behind closed doors if people in public thought do think like it's time for them to start a different kind of life. So
absolutely. And that's, we can go off on a tangent about that completely, because I'm very opinionated about that. That's actually one of the things I did when I moved to LA, because I worked at UCLA for a brief period of time, and I would pass their house all the time. Oh, so sometimes I do a little drive by, and I'm like, just, you know, morbidly curious. Anyway, I'm there with you.
Yeah.
So was there ever a moment when you were doing, you know, just research or general reading, when you were coming across true crime nonfiction books, where you felt a little irritated with how it was written? And is that what kind of propelled you to write a very victim-forward book? Or is it just something that you felt like was needed, or was there ever a point where you're like, why aren't we doing this right?
That's a very interesting question, actually, and I'm not really sure how to answer it, because it's almost like a chicken, what came first, chicken or the egg? Like, I kind of thought that I wanted to tell this story about the victims first, and then I realized there wasn't books like that, and I just, the clown stuff, like him as a clown, that was like so told already, like everybody knows that kind of aspect of it, that I just thought there was something more interesting in it. And I've always sort of gravitated towards coming of age stories. And this one was like, the whole thing was a coming of age story kind of cut short. And that really resonated with me in a different kind of way. I've always had this kind of weird fascination by the 70s too, and I mean, I wasn't born in the 70s, I was born in the 80s, so it's not like I have like nostalgia for it, but there's like, it's a youthful decade in itself, and it's almost like it is a decade of coming of age, like wrapped in like a perfect set of 10 years, because we've got the baby boom, and there's all these kind of like youthful things happening. There's sexual freedom kind of happening. Mm-hmm. There's drug use. There's music. Like, it's just kind of it to me is a youthful decade. And that kind of resonated with me as well. But it just sort of happened that there was also not many other stories at the time, and still really aren't, about that are really victim focused or told from the victim's perspectives entirely.
Right. And when you, there was a interview where you talked about how long it took you to write this book. Can you tell the listeners kind of the span of this? And once you figured out the bones, like what exactly you were doing here, how did you know exactly how to steer it? Like, what was the process of the length and timeline, and then figuring out the organization of it?
The timeline itself, it just, I had to learn how to research, and I had to learn how to track people down. I had to learn how to talk to people about a very sensitive topic. I didn't have any kind of like help with that. I had some tips and advice here and there, but the thing that really scared me was approaching people and saying, hey, tell me about like one of the worst times of your life.
Right.
One of the worst events in like American history in some ways. Like, that was very difficult at first. And I was very timid at first with all that. So it was a slow start just on my end. But also the amount of effort that it takes to track down people after, I think like 30 some years had passed by the time I started. Now it's like getting close to 50 years. People change names, people die, people get sick, people get married like multiple times, people go to prison. Tracking them down and trying to figure out where they are was extremely difficult. But then also making contact with them, making sure that it was the right address or the right email address. I would never like cold call anyone that I just didn't feel like I could explain myself and explain the project. You know, in a, hi, this is David, I want to talk about it. You know, you can't do that with any kind of nuance. So there was that. And then, you know, you have to schedule a time to talk to someone. You and I had difficulty with that. I had difficulty with like setting time up with Laura.
Editing Patches here. We say the name Laura a couple times during this podcast, so I wanted to specify on who that is. You're going to recognize who it is. So we are discussing Laura Norton, because David Nelson was on her podcast, The Fall Line, pretty recently. And the reason you probably recognize her name is because she was our February pick with her book, Lay Them to Rest. David was on her podcast discussing potential cold case victims of John Wayne Gacy. And that episode, by the time you hear this episode, should be out. If not, go give her page a follow. You should be following her anyway. She's fantastic. So that will be up probably at some point in mid-November. And back to the show.
That was difficult. There were people that also needed to be reassured that about the project, about me. And some people took a year before we actually sat down and talked and like actually had an in-depth conversation. And then the last thing is like waiting for documents to come back. you submit a FOIA mm-hmm. request and you might get like, oh, you know, 2 months later, we can't find anything. Okay, well, try looking at it under this way. So then you wait another 2 months. So there's mm-hmm. a lot of waiting for that as well. Or one person, you meet with one person and they tell you to talk to so-and-so or this person. And then you start the cycle again. Oh, I've got to wait, you know, a year or so before they're comfortable or they're available to talk. People get sick. A couple people I wanted to talk to died before we got to talk. One mother of one of the victims, I wish I had kind of tried a little bit not harder, but like just put a little bit more energy into trying to get time with her. But then she passed away very suddenly in it. I didn't get to hear her side of the story, and her family was kind of very adamant about her speaking as well and being heard, but it just didn't work out.
Oh, that's so sad. Mm-hmm. I had only learned in researching for this podcast that Karen, John Wayne mm-hmm. Gacy's sister, had actually died this year too. Did you ever get a chance to speak with her or connect mm-hmm. with her at all before she passed?
I did make some requests to speak with her. Because in some ways I think she is a different kind of victim in this story.
Absolutely.
But at the time that I was sort of making, I'm in contact with a lot of people that were close to her or, that were in contact with her for their projects. At the time I made a request to speak with her, she was kind of already maxed out on the amount of interviews, and she was trying to wind down on it and mm-hmm. write her own book, which I think did come out. So she was sort of putting it in the rearview mirror, and that was fine for me because I worried that might deviate a little bit too much from the actual intentions of the book. So I wasn't too disappointed, and I understood, you know, that she didn't want to speak with me. It wasn't too big of a deal. But I did see her from afar one time when she was in town filming a Lifetime show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was interviewing one of the victim's sisters who she was on the television show with, and we were watching her out of a window of a McDonald's. So where we were having an interview. Yeah.
Was that Patty that you mm-hmm. were? Okay.
Yeah, Patty Zick. Yeah.
That's so fascinating. And you said, you mentioned there was a victim's mother. Was there anybody else that you really, really wanted to speak with but didn't get the chance to, whether it be any of those circumstances? I mean, I'm sure you spoke with how many people for this book? I mean,
I lost track. I lost track. Yeah. Obviously, I wish I could have talked to members of every family. Mm-hmm. That would have probably been a bigger book and a lot more cumbersome to figure out and research and edit and all that good stuff. But then when I zoned in kind of on specific boys for this, I think there's probably about like 12 boys that really get their stories told in a little bit more detail. There were individuals attached to those boys that I wish I could have spoken to. For Billy Carroll, there was one of his friends, Marianne Rogers, I wish I could have spoken to her. She was interviewed in the newspaper right after he was identified in 1979, and I drew a chapter title from one of her quotes about how she had a dream about Billy a couple weeks or something before he was identified, and she said there would be a lot of light and a lot of concrete, and that's in the title for a chapter when they're discovering the bodies in the Summerdale property. She was close to him, and I heard from different other friends some details about her. But I could never get a line on her at all. Mm-hmm. And I did find a record of Marianne Rogers who had passed away well before I had even started researching. So couldn't speak with her. There were a couple like girlfriends of victims I feel like would have just told a really interesting side of the story. There's probably two or three people for every person I talked to that I wish I could have spoken to, that it just didn't come to fruition, or they're just not, I couldn't find them, or they had passed away.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I would absolutely lose track as well. I mean, there were so many people interviewed for this, and it was just such a great, because every person you interact with has a different perspective of you.
Mm-hmm.
So having as many perspectives would, you know, would make it so cool. And that's what I think this book did really well, was adding all of those perspectives, even the people that just went on like a couple dates with them. Like, that's a perspective I'd like to hear, you know?
Yeah. Well, and just to go back to kind of Billy Carroll for a second, very late on into the process, I think I was still I didn't actually start writing the book until like 2 years before it was two, like the eighth and ninth year of this whole project was when I finally got to write. But I was like halfway through the book when one of the cats is doing something. she's like struggling to get up on this thing. One of the things I found out was that he actually had a sister, which.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I had no idea. No one that I had spoken to ever mentioned her, including like some cousins. No one had ever said anything about it. And I finally did find one cousin through Ancestry that said, oh, yeah, he had a sister. She was developmentally challenged and they could not care for her, and she was given to some sort of group home where she lived her entire life until when she died not long ago, actually. So certain friends didn't know that. It was never reported. No one knew about this. And that time period is sort of, you have a lot of those stories of siblings sort of being shuffled off to some place. I think even the Kennedy family had a sibling. But I guess my point was, there were things that you're totally right about. You know, the friends knew this aspect of this person. The family knew this aspect. The girlfriends or the boyfriends knew that aspect, and then you realize that not all of them have the full picture of these very short lives. So it's very interesting,
Yeah. And you did an interview, I believe it's called Split Lip, the Mag?
Yeah.
Is that what it is? With Courtney Lund? Courtney. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you know that her mom knew Robert going into that, or was that something that you kind of discovered?
No.
Interview and you're like, oh my God.
No, actually, so Courtney has a book coming out in January. It's called Postmortem, and it's about her mother and her mother's ties to the John Wayne Gacy case. Told from it's really about her and her mom and generational trauma, motherhood, grief, all this stuff. I'm a character in the book at some point because we went and we kind of drove around to Splains and went to some of the sites when she came into town. But yes, we did know that connection, and we are doing some events for her book in January, and that was sort of an event we kind of did for me. So yeah, I did know that.
That's so exciting.
Yeah,
and such a connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I love in that article, and of course, I always link everything down that I'm referring to in the description of whatever you're listening on. Cool. But you refer to Gacy in this book as you know, Jaws, as the shark in Jaws, right? Mm-hmm. Not just like, you know, you were talking about how there was all these issues and Spielberg was like pulling his hair out. He was kind of like this ominous figure where you're reading these chapters, you're reading about these lives, you're reading about the fights they would get into and school they were skipping. And then at the end, you would end on like this ominous note where you're like, you hear that music, right? And I thought that was a great analogy. You know, when you were writing and interviewing, did you kind of forget at times that like, oh shit, this is actually about Gacy, like this ends very poorly? Like, were there ever those moments where it suddenly snapped and you were like,
yeah,
shark attack?
Yeah. And there was a point where I did a search on his name within the manuscript, and I had mentioned him maybe two or three times.
Wow.
Over the course of like maybe 170 pages or something. I don't know if that's how it ended up, but part of me was like kind of self-congratulatory. I was like, okay, I'm doing what I intended to. I guess it kind of happened accidentally, but I did kind of go in with that as well as I was outlining it. I was like, it's really focused on what happens before the case breaks, because I didn't want to pan in on his life and be like, oh, he was, you know, in the midst of talking about these boys, at least, I didn't want to pan in and be like, oh, here's the Hawaiian luau he threw in his backyard with a roast pig. Like, who gives a shit? Like, it sort of happened that way, and it made sense just to kind of have him lurking in the background. But that was also an interesting thing I found out about the case, because, you know, you have cases like, like the DC Sniper, where you where like people know that there's a Phantom out there. You have the Zodiac Killer with a similar sense. With the Gacy case, what I always thought was no one knew what was going on until the case exploded, and all of a sudden you have 33 victims. But there's this there's a group of people in of sex workers in or male hustlers, whatever you know we want to call them, that knew that something was going on at this time. And there, for this group of people, there was this Phantom out there. And I found that really fascinating. So I kind of wanted to play that up a little bit, that he was lurking in the background, essentially, that some people did know and some people warned about him.
It was interesting as well when we were, you know, in the trial, where there were so many eyewitness testimonies that were like, yeah, I saw that guy. I saw that guy. I got in a car with him. I escaped him. Like, there were just so many people who had crossed paths with this guy, and he didn't even, like, try to conceal it. And like, he introduced himself as John or Mr. Casey or signed things. And, like, he, I mean, this is, again, a different, like, you know, forensics. What is that? But it is, there were so many people that crossed paths with him.
To this day, though, stories like that are coming up to me. Like, are, I'll be in an Uber and someone will be like, oh yeah, I met him, or I was getting my haircut one day and this guy told me that he had grown up in Uptown and he had met Gacy. And I, some of the stories I'm like, okay, yeah, like, you know, maybe, but that one I was like, oh my God. And those stories, I mean, I had a coworker that was like related to, actually, no, I can't talk about that actually, because I don't want to, it's just kind of, it's, the case is part of Chicago lore.
Yeah, so big town suddenly gets smaller.
Exactly, yeah.
So, of course, I always have to ask, this is my favorite question on the podcast, and I always joke about that every time. Obviously, you couldn't include everything you wanted to in this book, not just because you couldn't get all the interviews that you wanted, but is there anything that you could tell us that got left out of the final product that you either wish was put in, or you, you know, what got left on the cutting room floor?
I don't... the final manuscript was a little bit long, but I didn't take anything too expansive out. It was mostly like, oh, this paragraph, like, what does it really do? There's, they always say in writing, kill your darlings, but I think, I don't think I did that here, but it really comes down to people I didn't get to interview that whose story I think would have enhance the book. And that's sort of the other thing about writing is like, when are you done? Like when is something final? And I don't think it's a final book. I mean, I could have gone on forever and ever talking about different people who knew these people or had some memory of them that painted a picture of who they were. So, yeah.
And we'll get into that later too, when it comes to like, unidentified victims still. Of course, that's also a big part of that too. I did listen to the episode with Kate Wrinkler Dawson on her Wicked Words podcast. I do need to connect with her because she is our January author, and I need to go ahead and get that scheduled.
Oh, nice, nice.
I forget that it's October and we're getting close to the end of the year.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So you mentioned though that the first person you spoke with was Denise, right? And that was Frank or Dale Lanigan's sister.
Yeah.
And she had a really tragic story to tell about just, you know, it seemed like it never ended for her, unfortunately. And she seemed to have a lot of the fulcrum of this book. Like she, her story about Dale had, we continuously revisited Dale's story throughout this book. And, you know, you mentioned that she had said on that podcast that she felt left out and like couldn't tell her story. Like she was left out of like articles or movies or whatever. And she didn't really have a chance to like talk about it. Why was that? Did she just not feel comfortable yet? Where she's still trying to like let the dust settle? Kind of walk us through if you can. I mean, that's kind of an invasive question.
Yeah, no. I think journalism and true crime back in those days was very killer focused. And it was always told by the people who were investigating or chasing these people down. So journalists wanted to get a quote. And, you know, we'll start there with, like, you know, the Sun-Times or the Tribune. They wanted to get a quote. Oh, he was a good kid and didn't deserve this or something very, you know, kind of standard for that time. And it doesn't say anything more about that person. And they really kind of focused and honed in on the parents. And once they got their quote, they were done. A lot of the parents got to tell a little bit of their story, very little, very high level, in the trial. And that was where Denise's father testified. But no one sat down like a, you know, like a Diane Sawyer or anything and talked about that with them. Oprah did a couple interviews in the 80s with some of the mothers. I've never been able to find clips of that or anything. But that was two or three of the mothers that were kind of very vocal. So it was just sort of circumstance that sort of happened, that she wasn't ever approached. But she, you know, she didn't necessarily seek it out too. She didn't go to, like, you know, talk to people or anything like that. It's just, it's kind of a tricky question to answer. There's a point in the book where she calls CBS because they're about to air To Catch a Killer with Brian Dennehy, I think. And she chews them out over the phone, like, how could you air this? And, you know, that was very focused on Rob Peace, the final victim. But I don't believe they contacted his family and got any information on that. So that was just sort of like, especially with this case, they just want the clown. They want the face makeup, and they want the salacious details about it. They don't want the details about the young men and what they were up to. So I just don't think she was ever sought out. And I think she had been kind of waiting for that to happen. That's what I learned about a lot of people, too, was that they wanted a chance to tell their story. And that's what sort of made me a little bit more confident as I went. I was very timid at first to approach people, but then I got more confident because a lot of people want to talk about this. A lot of people want to actually find some sort of catharsis or just at least put that piece of the puzzle, you know, together.
And there was a couple people that you had mentioned as well back then, once Gacy was arrested and eventually charged and everything, before they were done verifying the bodies, there were news crews like knocking on doors. Like, wasn't that the case for Billy, or where they hadn't identified Billy yet, but CBS was already in the lawn?
Was it Billy Carroll or Billy Kindred?
Well, that's true. There's also two Billys.
You know what? Yeah, it was Billy. Excuse me. It was Billy Kindred. I don't know if his family had been informed or not, but Mary Jane had not been informed by anyone, and all of a sudden, a news anchor or a newspaper writer was in her home, basically telling her that her fiance, who had been missing, had been found in the Gacy house. So there's a lot of that kind of journalism too. It's kind of like gotcha journalism. It's like, oh, so-and-so was just found dead. What do you think? And like, here's the microphone in your face. So there's a little bit of that going on too.
Mary Jane had a fascinating story as well, and just heart-wrenching too, that even to this day, I think you had said her kids are like, where'd you go, mom? You know, was it Billy? Like, because she, like, you know, it's having trailing off, reminiscing or whatever, and still wearing his ring, and that crazy moment where she tells her husband, like, what are you jealous of, a dead guy or something like that? Like, oh my god, she was fascinating to read about and learn about. And it's just so tragic how this has followed her. And Will, I mean, how is it not? You know, that's just something that's going to resonate and stick around. You can't do anything about that. Yeah, right. Mary Jane was fascinating.
She is. She's a badass.
Yeah, that's I got that vibes, but I didn't want to say it. So good. I'm glad. Yeah, she seemed like a badass.
Yeah, and this is like reminding me too. Like, I haven't checked in with either of them in a while, and like, we do text each other here and there, or catch up on the phone. And just kind of see how each other is doing. Yeah.
Well, that was actually my next question. Like, are you keep in touch with any of these people? Like, do you
send
Christmas cards?
I do exchange texts here and there with people, and sometimes Mary Jane and I catch up on the phone, which we haven't done in a very long time. But yeah, and I think this is, you know, some people are going to say, you shouldn't get so close to people like that you're writing about. And I'm like, who, like, what? Like, they're, who gives a shit? Like,
yeah, right.
They're not paying me to, like, write their story. Like, it's not like they're being friends with me or being nice to me so that I write differently. Like, they are just agreeing to speak about these murders is an implication of honesty and, like, this sort of contract of honesty between us. So, and hearing them about as young women or young boys dealing with this, like, what, I'm not just gonna put up a steel wall and say I'm not gonna start caring for these people, and especially the victims too. Like, after 9 years of like hunting down these pieces of their life, and then finally sitting down and getting to a moment where I have to write about their deaths, like, that was super emotional for me too. And I leaned on them, their siblings. And, you know, I like texted Denise when I was writing that. And I was like, this is very hard right now. So, yeah, I think, like, if you're reporting about like a political campaign, like, maybe, yeah, don't be sending Christmas cards to each other, but this is just kind of a different beast altogether, I think.
There's empathy in it.
Yeah.
There's, you know, it's, yeah. It's a deeper subject.
Right, yeah.
Absolutely. I want to talk about, again, the 70s. Let's revisit the 70s in Chicago and Uptown. There was a really fascinating part, page 81, and I'll read it because it's just great. What most of them didn't realize was that to Billy, like so many other kids in the neighborhood, an existence on those streets was better than any existence and any time spent at home. He could find money, friendship, love, excitement, and belonging in the street. Let's talk about life on the street at that age. Well, paint us a picture. What, you know, obviously you do in the book, but what was that like?
So that kind of zeroes us in on the Uptown neighborhood, which I live like kind of close to and live
in. I was actually going to ask that too. Like, where are you at? And, you know, are you near it?
I'm a little bit further away from that now, but for the majority of me writing the book, I lived at the top end of Uptown, I guess. And it's so weird that when you're starting to research this, all of the sudden you're like, oh, let me look up where this address is. And you're like, oh shit, that's like right across the street. Like Frank or Dale Lanigan's father lived in a building that I literally like was just like a right there. and when they identified Francis Wayne Alexander, the final victim to be identified, or the latest victim to be identified, he lived on Winthrop, and Winthrop was like literally the street like in front of my building. Mm-hmm. And I was like looking at it as they made that announcement. So Uptown was, and that's sort of how it got into the case too, was I was like, oh, these kids were walking the streets that I'm living on now. Like some of the places are still there, like some of the buildings, some of the restaurants. That's why it kind of took root for me. But Uptown in the 70s was so different. It was primarily white Appalachian. Sorry, let me say that again because I think I botched Appalachian.
No, well, you didn't. You said it right.
Okay. White.
Well, it depends on where you're at because Appalachian is where.
Okay, we're going to say that.
In North Carolina, it's Appalachian. Yeah.
So there were predominantly white Appalachian families living in there, but there were also, it was sort of a mixing or melting pot, for lack of a better term, of different ethnicities living there. There were, there's still to this day, a good section of Vietnamese Americans and great restaurants, like wonderful restaurants there. Mexican Americans. It was kind of changing a lot in the 70s, but the biggest group at the time were the white Appalachian families. So this area was very impoverished. It just wasn't a great area, and a lot of these families had addiction issues, which led to abuse within the family. So Billy Carroll's family, his father was very abusive, and so for him, he spent time out on the streets. Frank Dale Lanigan, his father was also abusive, so he was kind of wayward himself. And so on the streets, there's other kids of that background. They're from Kentucky, just like you are, or West Virginia, just like you are. and they formed gangs, and these gangs formed almost a pseudo family for them. They were, there was all sorts of different gangs that are lost to time with different names, goofy names. There were the Thorndale Jagoffs back in the day, TGO. There was the Uptown Gaylords, which I don't think you'd name a tough gang Gaylords these days. But then Latin Kings, which are still in existence, Latin Eagles, those were also kind of orbiting each other in Uptown. So there was, you know, older young men that were role models. They were like older brothers for you to follow, you know, follow in their footsteps. And there were girls to hang out with. And there was an ability to sort of prove yourself and prove your smarts, prove your toughness. And that's sort of why they gravitated towards these gangs and this sort of drifter life within Uptown. So it was very fascinating. You could almost write a secondary book, and other books have been written about it, but the gang life is very fascinating in Uptown in the 70s, or on the North Side in the 70s too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, I know nothing about any of that, so it was so fascinating to learn.
Yeah,
even, you know, from it in this book. But one thing that I think, you know, was crucial in understanding this was the vulnerability of victims.
Yeah.
And that's something that we've talked about with other serial killers. You know, we had a book about Ted Bundy over the summer, and that was a huge thing, too. And a lot of misconceptions, too, about how charming he was and all this other shit, when a lot of the times he grabbed these women when they weren't looking.
Yeah.
You know? And there's a certain vulnerability to it. And, of course, in this instance, these boys were very young.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that is something that I think does get lost completely with Gacy, is a couple of things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just the ultimately the vulnerability of these victims and how, you know, they were just trying to make friends. Like, they were just hanging out with their friends.
Yeah. And he had like a couple things that he could play upon to get people to first get in his car and to get into his house. And he had a lot of money, first and foremost. He was making good money in his contracting company.
That's one of my questions, is how did he always have money? But okay.
Yeah, his contracting company, he was making pretty good money. He had a big operation of renovating pharmacies all around the Midwest, including apparently a pharmacy in Albion, Michigan, which is where I went to college. And in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, he was making pretty good money on that. So he had a lot of money to toss around. That's attractive. He could also promise jobs to these young men, and he was paying a lot more than any other kind of job. So there was that. He had access to a lot of drugs, which kind of was primarily through those pharmacies. Sometimes the pharmacist would, or according to him, would pay him with pills, or I'm assuming he would probably grab some on his own, or got his hands on it somehow. So there were drugs, there was money, there was opportunity. It was just things that he was able to kind of offer these young men. But then he also sometimes posed as a police officer, too, and he could use that to get people to go
home. Same with Bundy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And, you know, so again, on the topic of serial killers, you mentioned Dahmer, too, which was really interesting. At page 134, I know it's the footnote, but Carol's Speakeasy. And apparently, before it closed down, serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer met one of his victims at Carol's Speakeasy?
Allegedly, yeah. and that's not to be confused with Carol's Pub, which is a honky tonk that I was just at a couple weeks ago, that has been there since the 70s in Uptown, sort of a product of that, like the migration back in the 50s and 60s. Yes, I don't think they ever overlapped, just from a timeline perspective, because Gacy was more 70s, Dahmer was more 80s, but I do think some of the places where they chose victims, there's some potential overlap there. You know, because Gacy did sometimes frequent some of the clubs or the nightclubs back in the day, like one called Crystal's Blinkers, where he picked up Russell Nelson on a evening in October, almost, I think it was actually October 18th. So exactly.
Wow, tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. So there might be some overlap in there, but I don't think anything other than that. And then other than the, and I think Ryan Murphy sort of played this up in the Dahmer series, where Gacy was executed in May 1994. I think that was around the time that Dahmer got baptized or something. And then there was an eclipse, oh, and Lord. He was trying to draw parallels with that. His depiction of Gacy, though, is, like, cartoonish. Like, it's so cartoonish. It plays up the clown makeup. Plays up the kiss my ass statement that he did not make, and in the execution chamber that didn't happen.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it plays up all that stuff, and I could go off on a tangent on that stuff. So
you're more than welcome to. We welcome tangents here. But I guess I was wrong about. I can't remember. Oh my gosh, you know, the serial killers blend together after a while, and I guess for some reason I thought Dahmer and Gacy were operating around the same time, but you're saying Gacy was just a little bit earlier than Dahmer, because I know, like, with, you know, with some of those serial killers, even with Bundy and the Green River, you know, whoever these guys are, some of them, they're like, I don't know which victim belonged to which. So there were no crossovers potentially to be like, maybe this was one of Gacy's victims, maybe this is one of Dahmer's, but I mean, they had very different MOs and, like, you know, what they would do and everything. But so there's no potential of that.
I don't quote me on that, because I don't know off the top of my head, like, when Dahmer's first victim was, but I know he was also in Wisconsin primarily, but I know that, like, one or two came from Chicago, so, but not as many as Wisconsin and maybe Minnesota, I'm not sure. I don't know that case all that well, just kind of the main points of it, I'm not sure, but there was a serial killer after John Wayne Gacy called, his name is Larry Eiler, who, there's not a whole lot of information on that's, like, as well known as Gacy, but Larry Eiler had several victims from Rogers Park. I'm pointing, like, in the direction of Rogers Park, and then a couple from Uptown as well. And some of the victims of John Wayne Gacy or their siblings knew the victims of Larry Eiler. So there is a little bit of overlap there. I don't know the time frame of Larry Eiler's murders, but there's, you know, potential for overlap there as well. I think that probably more than Dahmer, maybe.
Yeah, I didn't know about that person at all. I didn't know about him at all until you mentioned him in the book.
Yeah.
And the whole kiss my ass thing is interesting, because, again, back to Bundy, there were all these rumors and all these myths that the executioner was a woman because she had these long eyelashes on, and apparently that wasn't true. Kiss my ass, though, I thought was true. So I did not realize that that wasn't a thing.
That's been so widely reported in books, in media. It was in when they had that little depiction of him in the Dahmer show being executed. I think he says, kiss my ass. He did say, kiss my ass, leading up to the execution, but not in the execution chamber. He said it to, like, a warden or something, but those were not his recorded last words. He didn't have any last words. And I was able to verify that with Bill Kunkel, who was one of the prosecutors. He just recently passed away. He was one of few people actually in the, I guess, the observation chamber. There's that, you know, with the rows set up and the blinds come open and you see the prisoner. So he was there. There was nothing said, unfortunately. Or maybe that is fortunately. Maybe it's because, honestly, kiss my ass does sound like something he would say. He was a fucking asshole. Murders aside, he was a fucking asshole of a human being. He did not say that,
Interesting. Yeah, that's just, like, part of the lore, I guess. You hear that all the time that he said that.
Yeah, because it makes, like, a perfect, like, punctuation for a story like this. Like, oh, he was evil up until the end, or he was callous up until the end. Like, yeah, you know, kind of, it fits.
And I guess I also didn't realize, this is actually really not relevant to anything that I was going to bring up, but I did make a note of page 137. There was a part, Craig Connor, right?
Yeah.
And it was never verified whether or not, right, Craig Connor is still up in the air potentially being a victim, right?
Yeah, he is still missing as of right now. And I do think there's a possibility of him being a victim, and I do talk about him in the story in the book because of the commonalities and similarities he has with a lot of the victims. And I said this the other day too to Laura, anytime you have a young man anywhere from 14 to 25 go missing in the 1970s in Chicago, the first thing you have to look at is John Wayne Gacy. So that's why I included him in the book, but towards the end I was leaning towards more that he was not necessarily a victim of John Wayne Gacy. There's still that possibility, I think, but I do lean a little bit more towards Tex Richardson, his piano mentor, who passed away a couple years after Craig went missing. He died in 1979. But just witnesses have said he had a temper. He had a jealousy streak. He would lash out. And I could see some sort of thing happening between the two of them. And somehow him managing to cover up this crime, potentially. Craig did not disappear on his own. He didn't run away. He wouldn't have been out of contact for that long. So, I do think Tex Richardson potentially knew more, I should say, and should have been interviewed by the police.
If you help me out with my questions here, then
yeah.
Go ahead, keep going.
No, you go. Cause I think that was it.
Well, I did want to talk about Tex because I want to know your opinion on Tex and expand on what you just said. But this is a part, page 136 to 137. These books are not supposed to make me laugh. However, I think it was the way the audiobook narrator said it.
I've never heard this part, so maybe.
So chemistry also fascinated him, at least until he caught the bedroom floor on fire with his experiments. "Help," he said quietly, going back and forth from the bathroom with a small cup of water. Their mother quickly put a throw rug on the fire and stomped it out. But the way the audiobook narrator said, "Help," it just, I mean, I had to pause it. I was laughing so hard because I just picture this poor kid running back and forth just with this tiny cup of water trying to put the floor out.
Yeah.
Made me laugh.
That's funny. I haven't heard that part because I actually haven't listened to the audiobook, but maybe I'll give that a listen because it does sound kind of funny. And it was a funny story when I heard it too from his sister. Like it was kind of that's what I wanted. And I loved hearing those stories because it put together this like real life portrait and it made them very endearing in some situations. Like I wanted people to kind of feel that loss and feel sad by the, you know, when Craig was missing and there's no answers. I wanted people to kind of feel that too. And I think little stories like that help with that. So
yeah. So did you not want to do the audiobook yourself?
No. It's so funny because I've answered this question a couple times actually and recently. First of all, I don't have the voice for it. Second of all, there's no way that I could have read that book one more time than I already had at that point. Because it was in final stages and yes, a couple typos did slip into the hardcover. And if I had seen those, reading them aloud, despite the fact that I had read it aloud so many times, if I had seen those again, I would have flipped my shit. And I would have found stuff I wanted to change or rephrase. The book, like I said, is like always, it's never final because there's always things that you can do. And as a writer, you're always second guessing yourself. So I like flat out refused to do that. So yeah.
So the paperback though, I didn't notice any typos. So you're just saying the hardcover?
We caught.
I'm not very good about that kind of thing. I listen and read along at the same time.
Yeah.
And my eyes are faster than my ears, so sometimes I have the audiobooks on like 2.5, like ridiculous. You know, sounds like Courage the Cowardly Dog or whatever. I didn't notice any, but that part you got to listen. It's probably about, you know, just under halfway through. But the way the audiobook narrator said it just made me, LOL. So when it comes to Tex, though, Tex is such this interesting, you know, character in all this. I mean, you talked about him a little bit, but do you think he might have done this? I mean, this was like, I guess, his ideal opportunity with all this other chaos happening in the background. What are your thoughts on Tex?
I do think like he needs to be looked at or needed to be looked at as hard as John Wayne Gacy for Craig's disappearance. He was an individual who was close to him and had some sort of strange relationship. I'm not really sure about the, you know, there's sort of like a, it's a little bit ambiguous if they were intimate together. I think they were, but there was some sort of possessiveness over Craig as being his piano mentor. So
you're saying, wait, Tex and Gacy knew each other?
No. Oh, sorry. I hope I didn't imply that. No. Yeah, no, with Craig, there was a possessiveness from Tex over Craig
as his piano mentor.
And so based on sort of eyewitness testimony about Tex's kind of violent flare-ups or, you know, getting physical, that makes him a person of interest, if not a suspect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it definitely, you know, it felt like there was more to it, but mm-hmm. what was the reason that it wasn't really, just because he died? There weren't any reason to explore it further, or they just didn't care? Or
you mean look into Tex?
Yeah.
A lot of these cases, unfortunately, because the person is over 18, they're an adult, they can leave of their own accord. And mm-hmm. there's only so much that the police will do. To this day, I have not been able to locate Craig Connor's missing persons report. I don't think it exists. I think it's been destroyed. And that's the same thing for other victims who were not linked to Gacy. I think their missing persons reports are just gone because they're over 18. They've maybe run away, according to the police, or that's how the police assume. And then, especially back then, and I found that a lot of these police files just were discarded or destroyed or maybe lost. I tried to find records for a rape that happened in 1953 that involved Dale Landigan's father. I cannot find records of that. I don't think they were convicted. I think they were probably let go. And, you know, trying to prosecute a rape in 1953 was probably impossible. A lot of that stuff just kind of goes missing. And I also think that there's just like the police don't have their foot on the gas for something like that. They're going to go for the murder that they can solve or the other crimes that they can solve. They're only going to put so much energy into a 22-year-old man who's missing, who's gay,
right,
who might have run away because he's gay. You know, that there's not a lot of logic into that, unfortunately. So I think his case just kind of got sidelined.
So we talk about Tex, yeah. I mean, that is an interesting part of it that might be more than meets the eye, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, sorry if you're going to say something.
Along those lines, he was in a relationship. Craig was in a relationship at the end of his life or near the end of his life with some individual who might have gone by the name Teddy Caldwell. Mm. Anytime anyone goes missing, the person closest to them needs to be interviewed as well. There's not a whole lot that raises my suspicion about him, but I don't also know that much. So, and even if that was his actual name, we're not really able to verify that. I've never been able to find a record. There's not a lot of other people that knew him, but those are the three people that you need to talk to in relation to Craig's disappearance for sure.
It's interesting too. You talk about, you know, whether or not missing persons report even existed, you know, mm-hmm. or they could have been destroyed. Also, two teeth, like dental records. I didn't realize, which I guess I should have. It probably was mentioned in Laura's book mm-hmm. about how, you know, if somebody retires, they're just going to toss out the dental records. Like, is there not a system where we can, you know, maybe keep those in case said person goes missing? Or why? What's the point of destroying that?
I have no idea in with regards to that, because this is also the time of the Vietnam War, and you have young men going over to Vietnam, getting killed, going missing, Wouldn't you want to keep those records just for that alone?
Just
so,
in case.
I don't know, but like, there's people, like, they sell their practice and then their records go to that person and, you know, they probably get passed around or discarded. I don't know. I don't know why that happens, to be perfectly honest with you. But it makes things, as a researcher, it makes things very maddening because all that stuff is lost to time now.
Well, it's families too. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, what do you mean that's not, that doesn't exist anymore? Like, what do you, like, I need to help identifying my son. And this is the only way to do it. Like, they were talking about the crawl space was just littered with bones. Mm-hmm. And the only way that they could piece together who was dead by the teeth.
Yeah. Yeah. That is also, first and foremost, it is extremely frustrating from that standpoint. And in some cases, families were able to rely on other records. I think, like, Randy Raffet's family, I believe they had dental records. He went to the dentist on the day he disappeared.
Wow.
But he also had he had been stabbed, like, about a year or two before his murder in a gang fight or a confrontation that happened in Uptown. And so there were x-rays taken of his body at that time. And those x-rays were also used to verify. So you had kind of different avenues, but if you didn't have dental records, then you had to hope for something like that. Or some sort of jewelry or piece of clothing to verify. Sam Stapleton had a bracelet that was permanently sutured.
Welded on.
That helped. But after being buried in a crawl space, a lot of the identifying features, you know, a tattoo or something like that, those are gone. Clothing is gone. There's not a whole lot to go on. It is a very haphazard way of identifying people back then. I mean, it works, but it's still, nothing's quite like DNA.
Right. Yeah. And I don't think it was Kunkel. I can't remember who exactly it was, but whoever had the idea of searching the crawl space, like, it just felt like they had this, like, you know, push or this calling almost, like, check the crawl space. Like, you got to go down there and check the crawl space. And I thought that was so fascinating. And when he's, you know, yelling, charge him after he's holding, you know, that was just a remarkable moment. And, you know, the pictures, you can look them up online of them just pulling out the floorboards to not be in 2 feet of space and searching for all these. Yeah, that was remarkable too, where he's like, I just feel like I need to check the crawl space.
Yeah, and I have what I like to think is a little bit of a high tolerance for hearing those details and, like, kind of even, like, looking at the pictures. But there was a point in time where, and it's Dan Genty, the evidence technician, whose memory of this whole thing is extraordinary, both when he's testifying in the trial, but also present day, he's still, like, he's a great individual to talk to. That's when I got a little squeamish, just, like, hearing some of these details or, like, how difficult one of the bodies was to get free of the dirt and the mud. That's when I was kind of like, this is getting uncomfortable. Like, especially when you know who he's talking about. You know which body it belongs to, and there's, like, that emotional kind of squeamishness too when you're hearing that. It was difficult at times to go through that, but necessary, I think, for the overall story.
It's flooded down there too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was it the sub pump or something wasn't even on? So just, oh God.
Yeah. And then it's hot at some point too. I think, like, the furnace was on way too high, and then it's cold. Like, it's not a job I would have wished upon anybody to have to deal with. Mm-mm. Yeah.
So I'm making my way through the book here.
Sure.
Page 233. Mm-hmm. Kunkel and his team had their own roster of specialists who would counter any theories of insanity or multiple personality disorder. So at this point, you know, Gacy's been, you know, arrested. He's on trial. And of course, the defense, the first thing they're going for is insanity. Like, that's, like, the only thing. They have 27 people buried under, and they're like, well, this is all we have. We have to go with the insanity defense. Despite this, the case was not necessarily a slam dunk. Mm-hmm. And as the first day of the trial started, there was still nervousness, still trepidation among those who wanted to see John Wayne Gacy put away for good. Many of them had now come to take a stand. How in the world was this still not a slam dunk? And is it just because of that lack of forensics and, like, able to be like, no, we found that, like, you know, what the hell?
I think because this was like no, we hadn't had a case like this. We did have Dean Corll down in Texas, who was almost like the template for the Gacy case, but he committed suicide and never went to trial. So there is a little bit of uncharted territory when you get to the trial here. You know, what is it? I mean, there's always kind of that trepidation. I mean, you thought O.J. Simpson was kind of I thought he was kind of been a slam dunk, and he got free. Here as well, you do have that, like, again, that uncharted territory or uncharted waters of what is a jury going to accept? Like, can they accept that a sane person could live over 28 bodies for nearly a decade? And you know, accumulate them as he lived there, or could they see through that? And it's funny to hear that it wasn't a slam dunk, but it kind of was too, because Gacy's lawyers were not really equipped to defend this. They didn't have experience as criminal defense lawyers. And I think there was some infighting there as well on like how to handle the trial. And then they were also going up against some of the best with Terry Sullivan, Bill Kunkel, and Bob Egan. Like, they were experienced prosecutors. And in the end, the jury came back after only a couple hours with a guilty verdict.
Yeah, it was like 2 hours.
Yeah. Oh, so it was a slam dunk. Actually, it ended up being kind of a slam dunk, but you never know that at the start, especially with a case that was, we didn't have anything like this up until that point in America. And how was a jury going to perceive this? And a jury that was probably, I know they moved it, they moved jury selection to a place that was maybe potentially not as saturated with Gacy talk and Gacy media, but yeah, I think that was like near impossible. They saw those bodies coming out of the house on the news just as much as anybody from Chicago or anywhere else in America saw it at the time. It was everywhere.
And speaking of the demoralizing, I guess we could call it, when, you know, the defense was constantly trying to poke holes in testimonials and refer to people as, you know, troubled youth or homosexuals or all this other shit. And it just felt like they were literally, you know, grasping at straws here. But that seemed to be a big part of this, too, was the fact that some, you know, you don't know for certain, but some of these boys were gay. Mm-hmm. And that in that time had no weight to it. People then immediately stopped caring.
Yeah. And you can see that with one of the surviving victims, Jeffrey Rignall. He was tortured and beaten and raped by Gacy over the course of a whole evening. How he survived that physically, it's kind of a little bit of a miracle. But then when he was, I think it was when he was being driven by some of the cops to the police station, or in the interview room, they were making fun of the fact that he had been raped. And you, I mean, just to go back to the Menendez trial, even, like, that was a hurdle for some of the male jurors, I think, was they couldn't grasp the idea of a man getting raped. And so then you go back 20 years before that, it's even harder. And to see them as victims and to empathize and to hear their story and to take it seriously and then actually press charges or whatever, it was such an uphill battle. And I think Jeffrey Rignall even did his own investigation. Like, he staked out where he had been picked up or where he had seen the car, and he saw the car and followed Gacy home. He did his own police work, which is just insane. And I don't think things are completely better from a law enforcement standpoint nowadays, but back then it was even worse. So
50 years later and no progress has been made.
Yeah. And so to read it back then is like so frustrating. You just want to like yell and shake people and like more than that at some point. So
stepping aside from the trial for just a second, while we're on the topic, you know, what was What was this like, if you had to sum it up in words, writing mm-hmm. about this as a gay man?
Yeah, and I I didn't identify one until maybe like halfway through writing it too. So I was kind of a little bit of a late bloomer.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was. You know, I can't like credit it entirely with anything like that, but I did find myself like putting myself in their shoes a little bit more. And maybe gravitating towards the victims that I did know were gay, just because I was like, well, what would have been like in the 70s, you know? What bars were there, you know? So I did find some of those stories to be interesting. And to be honest with you, I had this kind of preconceived notion that I wasn't going to be able to tell those stories, because I had this kind of assumption that most men who were gay in the 70s had a very difficult time living through the 80s because of HIV and AIDS. So I was so pleasantly surprised and happily surprised that I was able to talk to people that had lived through that and that were still alive and had memories of this time, memories of these victims. And that was very rewarding to hear, and to get those stories and be able to be part of like recording those stories as well. Like, that was gratifying to me. I was glad I got to tell the story of young men and sex work happening back then too. Like, I didn't think I'd be able to tell that story, and I did get people who were comfortable telling me about it and explaining the rules and the, you know, the process for that, how that unfolded back in the 70s was fascinating to me and also rewarding in its own way to be able to tell.
And this is a super personal question, but in writing this, did that help you come out? Was that part of it? Or
I don't think I could credit it 100%, but it was hard to hear certain stories where boys were not accepted. Or, you know, maybe certain details I was asked not to share, not to publish, but they still shared them with me. That was hard to hear. And so I think a part of me was like, well, I'm not going to live like that. You know, I'm not going to be told a certain aspect of myself can't be published or, you know, can't be recorded. So there was a little bit of that I was kind of, I hate to say it like that, but like I wanted to live life to its fullest where they could not just because of family, but because of society itself. Like, it was rapidly changing in the 70s, but, you know, there was still a ton of work to be done.
Yeah. And there's gotta be moments where you're reading about these guys and their stories and you're hearing, like, say guys, young boys, and you're hearing these stories right. And you're just thinking, if only you were alive today, like mm-hmm. obviously things would be very different for you, but yeah. also different in that aspect of things as well.
Yeah. Like,
a lot of progress I think still needs to be made, but it's definitely better than it was.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great sentiment. You're right. I did think about that a lot. And I also kind of sometimes thought, like, if I had been, you know, at Crystal's Blinkers on a random yeah. night in 1970, and, you know, would I have fallen into that trap? Would I have needed a job or something like that? And would I have been, would alarm bells have gone off for me? And would I have avoided this person? Or would I, or even an individual like Tex Richardson, would I have been able to avoid a person like that? I don't know. In the 70s, you also, like, again, you didn't have this crime yet. People still trusted their neighbors. So people still
hitchhike and
strangers'
cars.
Yeah. Who knows? I probably would have done stuff like that. Who knows? I hope I would.
How could you not, you know, put yourself in some of their shoes, though, when mm-hmm. researching this? Mm-hmm. Like, there's, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we briefly talked about Gacy accomplices earlier. Mm-hmm. I do want to discuss Cram and Rossi. That's mm-hmm. their last names, right? Mm-hmm. They have an interesting story.
Yeah.
And you do kind of hint in the book that we might not be hearing the whole truth about this, because we do, from what we know, they were both either, I don't know, either definitely working with Gacy, digging the holes potentially, helping to an extent we don't really know. How much of their story do you believe?
Well, that's the thing, is their story hasn't been told. They talked to police a little bit. They testified. But they've never, and well, I shouldn't say that completely. David Cram was interviewed on like a, I think it's like a biography show or an A&E show way back in the 90s. And he's in silhouette. They use his real name, but he's told in silhouette. He's like, yeah. He committed suicide in 2000. So he can't tell his story. And Michael Rossi maybe will tell his story someday. I don't know. But I can't imagine them, if they do have knowledge of what happened in that house, that they would want to tell their story truthfully.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I do think, like, you can't live with a person who's murdering 33 people and not have some sort of knowledge of what's going on. It's just, it kind of defies logic a little bit.
Right.
Until they come forward and tell the story. But there's a lot of evidence that says, especially, you know, I should probably be careful with how much I say. there's a lot of evidence that at least one or both of them knew more than what they led on to believe.
Yes. Yeah. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
So on the Wicked Words podcast as well, you had mentioned that officially the number is 33, right? Mm-hmm. That it hasn't changed?
Yeah.
But you believe it's more?
Yeah, and I don't think it's like, you know, in the hundreds or anything, but I think there's a couple more that have been unaccounted for. After Gacy was arrested, he confessed. I take that confession as mostly truthful. I think he was truthful during that time. And I think partially because Gacy was raised in a Catholic household, Polish Catholic, Catholicism held sway in his life. He was seen towards the end, like, praying the rosary.
Oh, yeah, with rosaries.
Yeah. I think he saw that confession as almost like a religious confession. It was a chance to unburden himself and free himself from these 33 sins that he had committed. So I view that confession through the lens of mostly truthful. So, and a lot of the details he provides, like, you can verify against, like, the police investigation or details of the victim's lives, that sort of thing. So he talks about, after he stopped burying individuals on the property, he would drop their bodies into the Des Plaines River. And he says there's at least 5 victims there, and one potentially landed on a barge. So I think there's potentially a 5th victim that was in the river that we've never been able to locate, or that's never been able to be linked to Gacy. And then there's also a recording that I have that many people have heard, that was, I think, in one of the shows recently, where he talks about killing a young man with military ties and taking his body to one of the forest preserves. I've seen some records of young men being found. There were bodies being found in the forest preserves, but it's never been linked to Gacy. So that's now potentially a 36th victim. I could definitely see there being 36. And then there's also a question of a property on West Miami Avenue here in Chicago, if there's bodies there. Gacy was the caretaker of this property. I think he either owned it or his mother owned the property. I'm not sure. But he had ties to this property, and a police officer at the time in the 70s, who was a neighbor, walked by and saw Gacy digging at 3 a.m. There have been quote-unquote searches of this property in recent years. There are still some anomalies underground that can't be accounted for. Police won't dig. I don't know. I don't think you're going to find, like, 30 more bodies. It's not going to be, like, a huge graveyard. But if you found one or two bodies there, I would not necessarily be surprised.
Why would they not pursue something like that? I mean, does somebody live there now? Like, is that the type of thing that they're having to juggle?
That's a loaded question. It's a loaded question because and that goes back to, I think Michael Marino, one of the victims, and or one of the alleged victims, and there's a whole thing that continues to be a mystery. His body, according to Cook County Sheriff's Department, he is body number 14, according to an independent DNA report. That was secured by Sherry Marino, his mother, and her lawyer. Body number 14 is not Michael Marino. Right. Michael Marino is also, according to DNA, not body number 15, which is that body has been identified as Kenneth Parker, his friend that he went missing with. So, Michael Marino, where is he? And I think that scares the Cook County Sheriff's Department, is if they admit that Mike Marino is not body number 14, then other families are going to come forward. Other families of other crimes are going to come forward and say, did you actually identify my loved one properly? And can I get you to verify that? And then that's costs on DNA testing, costs on exhumations, costs on legal fees, all that sort of jazz is a whole Pandora's box. So I get why they don't want to do that. But I just don't think they want to make this case more mysterious than it is. They don't want to add to the mysteries that are kind of still lingering. They want to identify these, according to them, five unidentified victims, when really there's actually six, in my opinion, and many other people's opinions.
And probably more. I mean, you never know.
Yeah, they don't want to add to that the roster of unidentified victims, according to this case, that they solved way back in the 70s. And they've got new cases coming in daily. They want to focus on that. And I kind of get it from that perspective, but I also, like, but we also need to figure out the cases that happened 50 years ago. Like, that's, that's important, too.
It's important, And there was an article in the news recently, as you said, like, it just, we're never going to stop hearing about, fortunately now, I mean, this is a good thing. I would say we're never going to stop hearing about serial killers because, again, we don't know how many of them were actually truthful and how many victims they had. But also with the, you know, DNA testing and all this new forensic evidence that we're able to do, like, we're seeing these names back in the news like Gacy because we potentially have victims that we are finding, but there are also people who are thinking, no, one of my loved ones was definitely a victim of Gacy. And that is, help me with the name, Roger Aguirre.
Yes, there's another individual, Roger Aguirre, who could potentially be a John Wayne Gacy victim as well. And his family is making a big push for that. They've been in the media. They're going to be on the Fall Line as well, talking about his case. That I'll talk about his case on that podcast with Laura. And I'm hoping that we either get more of a definitive answer that he's not a victim. I think that's a start, but it then obviously then raises the question, well, where is he? What happened to him? Did someone kill him? How did he disappear in 1975?
Yeah. And his sister is saying there's, you know, she doesn't believe her brother's alive, but seeks closure. And they're also searching for his best friend known as Ernest or Ernesto, hoping that he might come forward with information. It's, you know, it just seems, it seems like these stories are going to continue because we're finally able to do the testing and whatnot. And it seems like there's an organization called the Light the Way Missing Persons Advocacy Project.
And I don't know too much about them, but they are, they focus on specific cases, you know, that have been, you know, that have hit a wall either with law enforcement or DNA or whatever. They kind of help put these cases out a little bit more into the public to get them, their names out there.
So what exactly can people do now? I guess to, you know, who's, you know, there's potentially six plus people left to identify.
Yeah.
What is something that people can do to help? Who should we focus on? If any, you know, what can we do to identify these victims?
It really is a hard question. I think getting their loved one's name out there somehow, as difficult as that might be, on a podcast and in media if they can. I mean, not every news station is going to say, yes, I'll feature you in a story. but there are these advocacy groups. There's the Charlie Project, which is really just kind of a blog that aggregates all of these missing persons stories. Craig Connor and Jeffrey Stinnett were individuals in my book that now have a page on that website. And when you look up missing people's, you know, missing persons in Google, Charlie Project is one of the leads that comes up. So that's a big avenue. Just getting their case out there, I guess, you know, posting about it, social media. There are a lot of people that make TikToks for true crime. That can help. And obviously, in putting their name to law enforcement to get it tested against DNA, you know, there's a huge DNA database out there that should be tapped into. If, you know, if that doesn't yield any answers, then I, you know, falling back on social media and other organizations to kind of get that name out there for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Like, I mean, I guess I just want to, like, the last thing I'll say is, like, there are still people that are unidentified in kind of adjacent to this case. Jeffrey Stinnett from Michigan, who went missing in 1978, Craig Connor, who went missing from Chicago in 1975, Roger Aguirre, who went missing in a month after Craig in 1975. I have lists of names of boys who went missing who were, you know, later found or who I'm not sure if they're still missing. There's still families and friends out there too. And I hope they come forward. I hope they enter their boys or their loved ones' names into the database and find some answers. Or if they're not victims of John Wayne Gacy, then I hope the truth of however they disappeared comes out, whether they left of their own accord, whether someone else is responsible for their disappearance. And if some of those boys are not actually Gacy victims, it helps to say their name in relation to the case, because the case is so big. People Google it all the time. It's in the media. There's news articles. It will lead them to that name. And that name then becomes kind of, sort of like, I hate to say it like this, but it's riding the coattails of that case. It gets out there. And maybe that leads to someone coming forward or remembering something. Stranger things have happened on old cold cases, so you never know.
Thank you guys, as always, for tuning in to this month's episode of Boys Enter the House, The Victims of John Wayne Gacy and the Lies They Left Behind by David Nelson. I hope you guys enjoyed the interview. And thank you for sticking around to the end to hear about the giveaway. So if you listen to our October episode 10 podcast episode that I did with Adam Barry on his book, Goodbye Hello, towards the end there, I discussed a giveaway that is happening for podcast listeners only. As you guys have probably seen by now, the Morbidly Curious Book Club is now a book box subscription service, and pre-orders are up, and this is starting January 2025 with our January 2025 book, All That Is Wicked by Kate Winkler Dawson. This, of course, was announced in October 2024 as a way to celebrate our 3-year anniversary with the book club. So by the end of the year, if you go and put disco ball emojis on the book box subscription post on our Instagram, 3 lucky winners will receive 3 boxes from 2025. I think one of my cats just jumped off of one of the towers. What was that noise? So if you post disco ball emojis in the comments, you are entered to win. And those will be announced at the top of the year, 2025. If you would like to join the Morbidly Curious Book Club, you can certainly do so. Just head on over to our website, themorbidlycuriousbookclub.com, or click on the description of whatever podcast platform you are listening on, and it'll take you right to it. And if you'd like to join a local chapter, we have some sprouting up all around the world. As always, thank you guys for tuning in. Stay safe out there, stay curious, and when consuming true crime stories, remember the victims.